the village forum. Now what that means is that everybody is an equal participant. And we hope that everybody that has an idea, has a question, has a concern, has an objection, will feel free to speak up. You can address your question to anyone else who has spoken, or you can make a question general to the group, you can make some statement. Anyway is appropriate. Any contribution is appropriate. We really take this idea of a forum in a very radical sense for all of us to be able to participate. It's not a lecture, not a presentation. Now, the forum, I've just discovered, is being recorded. There's a microphone hanging down here. There's another one up there. It can pretty well pick up anything that any of you would say. If you would simply speak clearly and loudly enough so that everyone in the room can hear you without any trouble. Don't talk just to your neighbor next to you, but speak to the group, and I think there'll be no problem. Now, we thought that it would be a good way to begin if one person were just to make a brief statement. And we're lucky to have in the village this week, actually for several weeks, Bob Quello, who is a pastor and who is spending some time while he's here reading about death and dying, about some of the theological interpretations of the meaning of death, about some of the concerns that a pastor who is also a counselor and a comforter has about death, and really reading about death in very broad ways. So I thought that perhaps you, Bob, could just very briefly make a couple of statements about what you think are important issues, and then throw it open for a wide open discussion of the sort of stuff.
Okay. I guess that you've already acknowledged some of the background for my concern, in that that I'm coming at it from a pastoral perspective, and yet a perspective in which I can't divorce my background. I feel like I, in some ways, have grown up in constant confrontation of death and dying situations, in that my father is a physician. And if nothing else, I feel like I was weaned in a hospital waiting room simply because of the number of hours that I ended up spending there, and watching in that process the reactions of people as they dealt with friends or family who were hospitalized, some of them getting well and some of them dying. I watched ambulance litters come in full and come into the hospital full and exit empty, and I watched mortuary litters come into a hospital empty and exit full. So that I felt like death is something that I've always been exposed to, but I've also noted some things about it. I noted, for example, that none of my father's patients died. They all expired. Now, maybe that's, you know, a technical difference someplace along the line, but nonetheless, there was a noted difference. I've noted that functioning in a parish setting, again, people seldom die. They are, as I hear conversation around the event, they are called home to God. They are taken by God. There are all kinds of phrasings that we end up using, and it seems to me that we are using them in an attempt to bring some kind of comfort in the midst of a grief setting, and yet have confused or at least put together an enormous amount of baggage into our conversation about death. The consequence is that when we talk about death, we're talking about everything from, you know, from a kind of spiritual relationship that is either dead or alive, to a physiological event or happening for an individual, or our responses to close friends or family who have experienced the kind of the internal struggle and the empty place that is caused by the death of someone else. And there's an awful lot of it that seems to me to get mishmashed. And that's part of what I'm trying to do in terms of some of my study, is to sort some of that out, and indeed to look at the whole concept of death, or the death event, and all of the luggage that we give to it, and to see how this all sets together as part of the life and the existence that has been given to us by God as gift, and to address that from a perspective of believer, of Christian. And at least in some of, to test in that process some of my own presuppositions, which I've started doing with Walt and with some others. And for the sake of some discussion, rather than to take a perhaps a more traditional tack, I'd like to take a non-traditional one and suggest that physiological death, as indeed it has been given to us by God, is gift of grace. And that that does not mean that there is not sorrow in it, or loss in it, or tragedy in it, but that a lot of that is associated with the description of our condition, the condition of our world, the condition of our relationships with God and with one another. But that ought not be confused or ought not totally taint the event of death itself as part of God's creation that has been given to us. You asked for a short statement, that's already longer than what you probably asked for. I guess I'm also anxious to do some hearing in terms of what is that our understanding of the event of death in a in a contextual setting of faith.
Okay, we really would like any and all responses. I think that Bob has suggested that death may be a gift, part of grace. A Christian ought to understand death in this way. Any reactions? Any problems in trying to understand it that way? Any objections? Is it an easy thing to do?
I'm okay with that as a way of understanding my death as God's gift. But I'm having real trouble with understanding your death as God's gift to me. because that's always a loss.
The people that are left behind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The bereavement situation is always a losing situation. And that's what makes it painful.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask you. How do you tell the person, like, say, I lost my husband 2 years ago, at the time he died, how do you tell me at that moment that that's a gift, when to me it wasn't? Like then, I realized afterwards, through time, it does become that. But at that moment, it was no gift. You couldn't administer it to me that way at that moment, I'm sure.
I guess my response to it is that to me, another person's death is indeed not gift of grace. There is that is distinct reality of loss. There's an empty place that has been filled by an individual, and there is real loss, and there is real pain in that setting. But that's my pain, and that's my ownership. And I think that there is a distinction that can be made, and perhaps indeed should be made.
You mean like it was my pain at the time?
Yeah.
I think there's another possibility, and I'm not sure that I can state this very well, but because it's really just occurring to me now, but let me try and accept the fact that it'll be awkward. Some of you may have been reading, it's been serialized in a number of daily newspapers, and I didn't read all of the episodes, I read several. An account by a British journalist whose wife was dying of cancer. They had together, as husband and wife, acknowledged that death was imminent, unavoidable, that there was going to be no remission. There was clear medical understanding, at least they accepted it, that there would be no remission, and that at some point the suffering and the pain was going to be so great that mercy would demand her being killed, at least so they believed. And they found a physician who was willing to cooperate and provided them with a lethal dose of some poison, which they kept, so that at the time when they, or at least the dying woman, believed that the suffering was so great that she would ask her husband to administer this to her, and he had agreed to respect her wish. Well, one of the episodes I read recalled the morning that she did die, and she simply said, "Is this the day? Is it time now?" And he said at the time, "I don't know how." He wrote in the article, he said, "At the time, I don't know why I said, yes, it is. But somehow, a gut feeling, a visceral understanding that, yes, it was the time. I said, yes, today is the day." And she said, "All right, I want you to go walk in the garden for an hour. And when you come back, I'll be gone." And so he gave her the medicine, and then he went for a walk and came back. And she said, "Well, he said that, of course, this is the greatest loss that he has ever suffered in his life. But there was something that she was able to give him as a kind of gift in the way that she died." And at least he believes that sharing her dying was a genuine gift that she was able to give, and that he understands more about himself, more about what it means to be human, and, well, we could perhaps from a particularly Christian standpoint, so I understand more about the ways in which God works in this world through the receiving of such a gift. Now, I spent some time working in a hospital with terminally ill patients, and there was a patient that I got to know really well who, when she died, I felt that the experience of knowing her had been a great gift, and somehow I was enriched in a way that I couldn't have been enriched in any other way. Now, I think that can happen sometimes. I don't know whether I believe, in my case, if I were losing someone who was very close to me. You see, if one of my children were to die at the time when my wife dies, if she dies before me, you know, whether I will feel anything like that at all. So I'm speaking this very abstractly and very tentatively and really raising it as a kind of question. But I wonder, and I would really like people to respond to this in whatever way you think, but I wonder if there isn't some sense in which the loss of a loved one or a friend or an associate, a colleague or a co-worker or something, couldn't be a gift to us. Does that make any sense to anyone?
No. I'd like to respond to that. And not that I had someone as close to die as the lady from Saskatchewan spoke of. Not that. Nor do I agree with the thought of, I believe Andrew did this correctly, of the people in the story who actually hurried her death. I can't agree with that.
Yeah, that's a different issue we might want to talk about later, but let's set it aside for now.
Yeah, we'll set that aside for a moment. But I do want to speak to that thing about death being a gift and also being able to rejoice with the person who received the gift, which was really going to a better place, this life everlasting. And I can speak to that. I don't fear death, having come to the threshold of it, as I spoke this one evening here, and some of you heard it, and being able to see that light and being in the wonderful presence of, I know that this was the presence of my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. It was the warmth, the joy, but I couldn't cross the threshold. And this took away the fear of death, which I had had for all so many years. And I just praised God for that gift of being able to see just a glimpse of it, just a little glimpse of it. So think of the joy of actually crossing the threshold. Now, if you had been given I don't know what, something you wanted all your life, we'll say that, let's say that your dearest loved one received that gift. I think we should be able to rejoice with that person in receiving that gift. And we strive toward that.
I guess I do at this time. You know, it's 2 years now. But at the time it happened, I didn't.
Yeah, I think there's a very real sense where we must also be able to affirm the fact that this life is gift of God also. And the relationships that we have in this life are gift of God. My first close experience with death was with a grandmother when I was in seventh grade. Very close in terms of family relationship. She died in the midst of the night. The afternoon before, she spent a good deal of time with each of the grandchildren talking about dying, because she knew she was, and all the rest of us knew she was. She acknowledged that, you know, there is pain that goes along with it. It's the same kind of pain of separation. We had lived in Texas for some time while I was growing up, and she lived in Minnesota. Whenever we ended a visit, there was pain in leaving. You know, that pain of emptiness, of the lack of the physical presence with one another, is very real. And you know, and I would never want to deny that. But I guess that I would also affirm, at this point, a ninth grade girl who, in talking about her seventh grade brother's death, and talking about about what that whole process of promise is all about. I said, kind of rocked back in her chair and said, "Yeah, and to think that Marky got the first crack at it." You know, there is something maybe naive about that. We would say, "Well, it's a nice naivety to have if it's naive." I think it's also an honest reflection of what we, of what our theology is all about.
A couple of years, last year, was my best friend's mother. I think I was probably closer to her. And she died, and it was sort of sudden. And I guess for a couple of days I was really down, and it really hurt a lot to have her gone. And then one day I just started thinking about her a lot, and I thought about all of the good times I'd had with her, and how we'd sit around and laugh and all that. And I realized that there was a lot of memories, and it felt, made me feel really good. And like now I sort of see those memories as a gift that I don't ever want to give up. I think that when she died, it sort of signaled an ending to our relationship right there, and it made me think about, now they've just been memories, and they're sort of a gift. And
I can understand how sharing in, the process of someone's death, especially, if they're a Christian and really witnessing to faith and hope in everlasting life, that would be a real gift to a family or friends or whoever sharing experience. My real concern is that I don't see the majority of deaths happening in such a way that anybody really gets to share in them. That they're either tragic and really sudden, say in a car crash, or they're hidden away in the hospital. And especially I think about the kids. And I can say this from my own experience, because my father died when I was in kindergarten. And that he was sick for many years and in a hospital. And we didn't get to see him at all, like the last couple of years he lived, and that is terrible. Especially kids, they can't go into hospitals. Like, you have to be, 12 or 13? And they're supposedly being protected from it all. But I think it's more harm, because then, in their own minds, they're, well, I know I did, I made up all sorts of ideas and imagined all sorts of things about what was happening and why it happened. Even doing such things as thinking that I was to blame for, some crazy reason. I can remember those things. And I think that if we're going to look at death as a gift, we've got to bring it out into the open so people can share it again.
I agree. I think something that really has to be, for someone I work in a hospital, and people that work in a hospital have to be taught, or have to have be taught how to react to death and how to help the person toward the end of it. Because it's the hardest thing to walk into a room and have someone there, and they're, that they're very close to death, and they want to talk, and all this. And if you're unprepared and if you don't know anything about it, the most you can do, you just listen, you just, what do you say, fake it, you listen, and not try and minister. But that's the hardest part, I find. Like where I work, though, they changed the rules so they let kids of any age out. Mm-hmm. you know, which I think is a good thing, because I've seen kids go in there, you know, and they're frightened at first of all, the tubes and everything like that, but it's still dad, or it's still mom, and they get used to it. I think kids adapt more to that sort of thing than adults, even. It's hard.
How does the patient react to having the family, and, like, can you, you know, compare to situations in your mind where the family was in and where, and where they weren't?
Yeah.
Does it comfort the patient any, or?
Well, it depends upon how the family reacts, like husband and wife. You know, the wife could, most likely, you know, the person that's dying accepts their death before the family does. You know, like, it's really hard to cope with a family where they don't accept that the person's going to die in the next couple of days or die soon, and the mom or, you know, or the wife is, no, she's going to die, and she can't talk with her family about it because they don't accept it. They say, well, they go and talk, well, you'll be up working in the garden soon and all this stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's really hard for her or him or anybody because they want to talk about it. They want to say, well, I want to make sure that this is done. You know, I want to make sure that when I'm gone, this will be done and all this stuff, and they won't listen. So that's one thing I've noticed.
But in that sense, when you said, you know, I can't really minister to them, all I do is listen.
Mm-hmm.
That listening,
yeah,
is maybe some of the most profound ministry that can happen.
Yeah. It's really, really, really wretched to sit there though and watch them die. It's just, it's really, you know, you can't get used to it, you know. You work, like, I haven't been there that long, but, I work on a floor where death is it's common because I work in Rochester, Minnesota. I don't know if you ever know where that is, where the Mayo Clinic is, and it's a last resort for a lot of people. They come there, you know, if they can't get help, they die there. And most of it's by cancer, which is an awful death. Anyway, and that's my trouble because I still am not used to it, you know, watching someone die.
I don't think that person could ever get used to watching or being with the person who died. I know it's on a deathbed. I've only been with two persons in my life who at the time that they died. Very fortunate that both of those persons were strong Christian persons who knew where they were going. They were not afraid. They knew their Heavenly Father would welcome them, and that they were ready to. They were ready. The one was a young man, and the other was my mother. And I like what Mary said. That Mary Schramm said the other day, the other evening at Vespers, where she said she spoke of this person who was helping the other person to die, in this respect that she held her. And that's all she did. And I've forgotten how long this went on, but recall it went on a long time, and that's all this girl did, was she held her. And I think that this is very important, as was just spoken of here, that that's one thing we can do. We can be with the person and just be thankful that nurses and hospital and doctors allow it. And I agree that there's a time and place for that too, just listening or just being there. And both of these deaths that I speak of were such, I know it sounds silly to even say it now, they were joyful, that both persons, they were joyful, it just so happened. I know there's only two cases, but it just so happened that they were granted a peaceful and joyful death. In this respect, they just quit breathing. And there was just a shell left. They weren't there. When they quit breathing, they're not there.
We have an organization in Thousand Oaks called Hospice. I'm sure most people have heard about it. And they help the person who's dying. They let the person go home and die with the family. And they do. It consists of a team of a nurse and somebody who's trained in psychology. psychology or whatever. And the nurse, particularly if there's pain, always administers just enough painkiller that if there is, they can still function and take care of all the things that they would like to do and not be in, not able to communicate. And they work in a beautiful way in which they enable the patient, the person who's dying, to talk out all the things, and they're able to answer all the questions with the family and get them to talk out. And I have seen several situations in which a tremendous growth and understanding of death and come away with a very mature, good feeling of having been there and been a part of it. And I just so high on hospice that I think it ought to spread across the country.
I think the hospice is something that's probably being resisted, as a lot of things are, by the American Medical Association, which irks me at no end with those people. But I can't possibly imagine what it must be like to die as an institutionalized person. I spent just a week myself in the hospital this winter and hated almost every minute of it. It was uncomfortable, there wasn't anything to do. You know, if you're away from home like I was, there's nobody to come and visit. And you just start piling all those things together, and then you add to that the fact that a person's dying, and America is a youth-oriented society. We don't like death. We shuffle people off into death wards and let them kick over and things like that. You know, why don't we bring people back into the home and make death a family thing like it had been for centuries in the European countries, where it was a big celebration? And they used to take pictures. You'd get the whole family around the coffin and take, no, this is true. Get the whole family around the coffin and take a picture with the deceased. And it really became an event. It brought the family together, and you learned a lot of things from it. But to die as an institutionalized person, I don't know what else. I'd rather die first than be institutionalized.
Yeah. One thing that I found with that, you know, you have to have the family accept that the person is going to die in order to take them out of the hospital, say. Because sometimes you've got a family there that wants all these nurses there and the doctors there and the tubes in and everything like that, they want it, even though the patient doesn't. The patient, many times, you know, in the middle of the night, put their light on and say, you know, I want to talk and say, you know, why can't I go home? Why can't I go home to die? And I just say, well, you know, I don't know, Mary, you know, your family, you know, doesn't want you out of here, you know? What can you say? You've got to have the authority to get them out of the hospital, you know? Like the doctors, we've had people that have gone home, but some of the doctors want them to stay. Some doctors just don't give up, you know? They just go on and on and on with their pills and injections and stuff. But some, you know the end is inevitable and tell them, you know, but some still stay. They feel more secure. You know, the family does. That they've done all they can, you know. I don't know. That's one impression I get, because that's a problem we've had before.
I think until we start in our homes with our children and make them realize that death is a gift as well as life is a gift, I think that's where we have to really start now. And make it an important part of life, because it is life and death, and it's all part of the gift.
I think it's a problem for a doctor, because death is a failure.
Exactly.
I think it's really neat what this lady experienced back here, where she came so close to death that she got a glimpse of what was to come after. I think probably most people here are aware of that book, Life After Life. And I don't know what other people think about it, but I really enjoyed reading that. And for the first time, I, you know, lost every fear I had about death, like when it would come to me. The things that go on in this book, it just makes it really exciting. You know, like it's something that you're really looking forward to experience it. It's the first inkling I'd ever have of what it might be like. And, you know, if it's anything at all like that, it's just, you know, a really exciting thing that it's going to happen to you sometime. Especially, you know, in your Christian, you know
that your salvation is going to come.
Who wrote that?
Moody, mm-hmm. I believe.
Yes, Raymond Moody. He is a physician and also has an advanced degree in philosophy. And it's based on interviewing lots and lots of patients who were judged clinically dead and then who were resuscitated and who recorded experiences of light and warmth and joy and sometimes music and so on.
Have you read this book? Yeah. Is it similar to what you experienced?
I read it after the experience I had myself and having had that experience myself. I hadn't told anyone about it until after I read the book, probably because I thought, well, people think, you know, that. What'll people think? So then after I read the book, I had the courage to tell my husband, and he was aware of something that had happened to me, too, because there was more joy in my life. But it turns out that, Kubler Ross's story, too, are true experiences, I believe, definitely. And there, as you mentioned, there are so many parallels in all of those and all of those things.
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has started some research into the area of people dying and then coming back and their experiences and what they feel. They say that very often they're met by a religious figure or a relative on the other side who welcomes them, and then for some reason, you know, they get drawn back. People don't want to come back and all these other things we've talked about. And a couple of months ago in an interview in the Lutheran magazine, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross stated that she was afraid to publish her findings and to do lots and lots of research and make it into a full-fledged project because she was afraid that publication of the things that she's found out could possibly lead to some things that she wouldn't want. For example, an increase in suicides because of the people who want to die then because they know what's coming.
Along that line, nobody has spoken in opposition to your first suggestion. And I understand, although I've not seen it, that there's a book which may be bigger than Life After Life called The Last, or Death, The Last Right, R-I-G-H-T. So that we're all headed that way, it seems, toward it becoming a very great thing for us. And are we pushing it on into the suicide?
Yeah, I'd like to pose another question at that point, and that is a sense of, it seems to me part of what is happening in the account or in the reading of these accounts of the experiences of the individuals, not to withdraw or distract from the experience of those individuals as being their own and uniquely their own, maybe even common or having common elements. But I wonder if there isn't also a danger of starting to put our faith in those experiences rather than faith and trust in a redemptive Christ.
I have another concern about those people who witness death or experience death in a way that it's just opposite of what we've been talking about, in ways that are extremely painful. People who aren't Christians, that don't have a faith in what's coming, that die in a real violent way. And I just think of, war on the battlefield or something like that. How can you even say to a person who has watched, his buddies being killed on the battlefield or has shot down other soldiers that death is a gift?
I would not suggest the manner in which that which produces that event, or precipitates that event, is gift.
Mm-hmm.
is definitely a result of the disorder. I would still hold that as being somewhat distinct.
Okay, then I understand that, and I guess that really wasn't my question. My question was about someone who dies fighting death. Maybe it doesn't happen. Maybe all people die peacefully. Oh. But if a person doesn't believe that anything neat is going to happen afterwards, that they're going to have everlasting life, and they fight it all the way, and other people witness that, then I think that for those people that witness that, death would be a very frightening or questionable thing, and that it would be hard to see the death as a gift in that situation.
I'm convinced in my own mind that I will fight death to the last possible moment. I guess part of the New Testament statement of making death like a sleep maybe speaks to me more than any other, because I'm night people. And anyone who knows me well, my wife will tell you, I will put off going to sleep until the last possible moment. And some would accuse me of putting off going to bed until actually I've been asleep for quite some time. And I would not make any statement or implication that that the Christian does not face a violent death or a painful death or a wrenching death. I think that's totally erroneous. That happens. You bet. And I have no doubt that I'll put off death like I put off going to sleep.
But you won't be afraid of it, will you?
Pardon?
Will you be afraid of it?
How do you really know?
I don't know. I don't think so. But I don't know.
I think
there will be fear, yes. At the same time that there is trust and confidence.
But what if you didn't have the trust and confidence to go along with fear? But I can't see, that a non-Christian would have the confidence in that to go along with it.
Well, I think it makes a difference how long a person has had time, how long time they've had to prepare for death. Like, it may sound corny, but if you ever read the book Death and Dying, she outlines definite stages that people go through, before they actually die. I can't remember denial, some anger, and all this stuff. And like, if you haven't had time to go through those yet before you actually die, if it's a very, quick, it seems like I only know one person who's never really had time to do it. And then it tends to be, they're more unsettled. It's hard to describe, but there I can see fear. If they haven't had a chance to get out of their anger stage, before they finally accept their death. Does anyone, what are the stages,
Yeah, well, the stages are brief. I just comment briefly that, they don't all occur very often.
No.
And they occur in all sorts of uh-huh. orders. And the amount of time varies widely.
Oh, yeah, so I know. But like with someone who's come in, with, acute appendicitis, something like that, which can be fatal once in a while, something like that. And if they do die, for someone who's only 15 years old, that's a very frightening thing, because they don't even know anything about what's going on. All of a sudden, for someone who's a little older and had the chance to have a week, months, years, seems to be easier for them.
I don't think these sorts of generalizations can be easily made. Two cases come to mind. One is a fairly young man who thought that he had something like arthritis. Been living on aspirin for about 6 months, and that didn't help. Discovered that he had cancer that was metastasized very widely throughout his body and died within less than a month after his first visit to the doctor.
Yeah.
As far as I know, the man had no religious convictions whatsoever. His attitude, and as far as I know too, he was happy with life. His attitude was, well, you know, some days are better than others. It was almost like that. Another person, though, that I knew, an older woman, who had had cancer for a number of years, who had been anticipating death for approximately 20 years, kept having remissions and so on, and finally had a bout that was about 18 months, who was apparently a devout Christian. At least she was a regular church person. She used a lot of God talk. I was with her when she died, and she, well, she never accepted that she was going to die during the last month or so. She was denying all the time, fighting, scared to death, angry, and the moment of her death was a protest, and a scared protest. So that I think that it's very dangerous business to try to speculate about how you or I are going to die. All of us would like to think that we're going to die very nobly, courageously, and that our loved ones will be proud of the way we die.
That's true.
I just think that one can't see any easy correlation between the way you die and what your character is. And there are probably organic reasons for this and all sorts of reasons, but you know, I don't think that that one ought to make assessments about what kind of a person is because of the way they die.
No, but I think that Kubler-Ross gave his cat given not a generalization, but a chance for people to kind of put this in order so that they can see where a family and a person is at to help them.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. The only point that I wanted to make was that sometimes the stages don't go in the order, mm-hmm. and you may go back and forth. And you don't work always toward the kind of resolution mm-hmm. Of the grief process. Sometimes it just doesn't happen that way. But I think that the work she's done has been very, very helpful. Understanding the anger of a dying patient, I think, has been very, very hard for a lot of people. It's been hard for people in the medical profession who used to talk about good patients and bad patients. Mm-hmm. And Kubler-Ross has really, I think, allowed for a lot of understanding about why anger is a very understandable element of the grief process.
And that isn't just the person that is dying either, that's the family.
Right, mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Nor is it just limited to death events.
No. All sorts of losses.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question. I'm not sure I'm following it. So that if we're going to look at the death process as a gift that individuals can give to those surviving, do we just expose them to the nice deaths that people accept and all that, or do we expose them to all of, you know, allow them to be exposed to all the different kinds of deaths, and how do you help someone understand a death that a person hasn't accepted? Follow me? do you follow the question?
I don't suppose you can control what types of death people see. You know, there's just no way. You have no idea what you're going to be exposed to.
Right. So then, is it better to keep ourselves, to keep death hidden, to keep ourselves
open? Absolutely not.
Is death the gift or is salvation the gift?
I think both.
I don't remember very many places in the Bible where death is seen as anything but an enemy. It's a conquered enemy, but it's an enemy, and I don't think it's ever seen as anything but evil. The fall of death. And
I think bad deaths are because death is bad. And I think salvation is what we tell people. I don't know, but I think so.
But if you really believe in Jesus Christ as your Savior, when you die, you're just being born into a different life. Really.
Yeah, but you gotta go through death to get there.
Well, you had to go through birth to be born also.
Yeah. But I just don't think we can expect it to be pleasant. And I think in a way it's a gift to realize that we don't feel that if it's unpleasant, that it's somehow wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, if a person who has their heart has stopped and they were pronounced dead, and the doctor and nurse said that he was dead, for, well, met, they said, the doctor and nurse said his heart had stopped beating and he, they were not for 3 minutes able to bring it back, but they did start it. I wonder if this dear friend of mine, Lloyd, I wonder if his report on how he felt would be interesting to hear. If you'd care to hear what his report was, then Dr. Tell us.
Well,
I
don't want to bore anybody with it. That's why I wanted to tell them if you want to hear that. But he, for 3 minutes, and he's alive and well today. There's nothing wrong with him. His brain is fine. His heart is fine. He enjoys life. And he's a man who, well, he confesses Christ. Speaking of salvation, as you just did there, salvation is something he loves to talk about. He loves to talk about his Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. But the point I wanted to make was that after he came to again, he was able to tell his wife, and his wife was who he told first. He said, and he experienced the same parallel, a bright, warm light, a wonderful time, a feeling of comfort, joy. He walked through a dark tunnel, but then he came to this light, lighted doorway, and he walked through the doorway. And that's the part I was impressed with. He walked through the doorway into the light, and a voice said to him, "It's not time." And he came afterwards, when he came to it. Of course, they did bring him too, with all the devices known to him in this wonderful hospital he was in. And he came, when he came back and was able to tell his wife, he said, "I'm disappointed. I really wanted to stay. But now he's enjoying life. He says, I know the Lord has intended something for me to do yet, and he has published that story of that experience he had anyway, all over the United States, and he received phone calls at night, daytime too, asking him about that wonderful experience. So he says, I do believe, I know the Lord intended me to tell it. And he tells, well, he tells it wherever he is.
But the wonderful experience was the experience in the beginning of salvation, wasn't it? Isn't that death?
Yeah. That's the point of
the whole thing. I think you've put the finger on what is a real point of tension. In terms of biblical reference as death as enemy, that I don't think that we can whitewash. I think it's easy to do that. I guess that, you know, part of what I'm struggling with is also that, you know, that tension to be sure, or to clarify, at least in my own mind, what is really being addressed. Because there, you know.
What are the alternatives that you see this being addressed?
I think there's a great deal of enemy nature that is involved in in depth, but I'm not sure that it is only addressing a physiological event. Okay?
Okay, so if it's not addressing the event of death itself, then would it be? Is it more symbolic to me?
No, I think that there are some segments of Scripture that seem, at least to me, to be dealing particularly with using life and death terminology in description of relationship with God. Description of our relationship with God. Using it some of that terminology is used in description of faith stance, not specifically in terms of physiological event. I think that there is indeed, even in physiological event, that there is enemy in the context of the experience of the disorder, the sinfulness in which we are functioning, in which we are living.
The thing that strikes me is very satisfying. I've read both Kubler Ross and Raymond Moody. Their research was done independently, and they come up with practically identical experiences with these supposed terminal patients that had experienced death. And some of the incidents that have been related here this evening seem to support that very same thing, as well as your experience that you mentioned here one evening, having interviewed this 44-year-old gentleman, or whatever it was, which is quite similar to these experiences recorded by Raymond Moody and Kubler Ross. I can't see that there's much difference in what they have recorded or has been related here. Now, in my own case, I would say, having read that and listened here, it would tend to support my faith rather than detract from it, because these experiences seem very beautiful to me. Mm-hmm. Then I read a book, I don't know if I pronounce this right, I think he was a French author, Paché or something like that, an attorney, who comes along and supports biblically, in a very scholarly manner, that there is life after death. And then putting all those things together, it certainly has, in my case, strengthened my faith. Now, I don't know at this point if I could speak to my own experience of being faced with death, whether it would be a comfortable feeling or an uncomfortable feeling. I'm not speaking of physical pain. I know that all of this has supported me and given me strength so that I feel that I could face death more realistically and with more assurance that there is life after death, that this transition would be a beautiful one. I firmly believe that. Experienced death in my own family several times, my own wife, which was very traumatic in my own experience because it happened very fast. But we had discussed death, dying many a time, and she was given her wish. She said that when she was removed, the Lord called her home, that she hoped it would be fast, and it was fast. I'm sure she prayed that it would be fast, no matter half an hour. And it's true that it is a traumatic experience in anyone's life, losing someone that you have lived with for 44 years. You can't help feel sorry for yourself, at first especially, until you kind of get your feet on the ground, so to speak. But you spoke of blessings and related things that were passed on to you from one that you loved very much. And those are experiences that help you to live with it more realistically, experiences that give you a lot of comfort. I think they are blessings. And to multiply that, the support you get after everything is over from friends, Christian friends, is tremendously helpful. The most support I got was from a young nephew of mine. My pastor never called on me during that first year. Now, I'm not saying this to be critical of the pastor. I know they're overworked. And he was very concerned. I never called on my home. But these are blessings that come as a result. Experiences that you have through life together, the supportiveness you get from Christian friends and relatives are the most meaningful blessings that come to anyone, I think. Oh yeah, maybe didn't mention, but Kubler-Ross and Raymond Moody, they did not collaborate. They, as I remember, having read these books, there were none at different intervals and independently, as I recall.
I think an important thing for all to face up to, and you suggested that your experience says something other than that. Many physicians and many pastors are just terrified of death. And working in a hospital and working in a chaplain's department, it became evident that people who, as an occupational group, seem more often to have real difficulty accepting the reality of death include physicians and pastors. And I think there's a kind of social problem that needs to be addressed. Why it seems to be this way, I don't know, but I really believe it is.
Bob, could you say a little more on what you were talking about Patty's comment here about how death is evil and about how the experience of it told us something about how we were living in sin here? I didn't catch that.
No,
it sounds really like it really says something. I missed it. Did you?
I guess I would, you know, I think that death as it, you know, you don't talk about cancer, you don't talk about warfare, you don't talk about, you know, how deaths happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think that that forces the, you know, the direct and honest facing of the disorder in which we live, the sinfulness, the disharmony. And I think that's, you know, that is facing evil, and facing it squarely in a very ultimate kind of way. I think that as I indeed even look at my own death, though I confess faith in God, and though I, you know, acknowledge baptism as a kind of ongoing event, and you know, claim what Christ has done for me, I still end up facing also the realities of the parts of my life that I'm not so awfully happy with. The parts that that I have asked forgiveness for, that I have received forgiveness for, but I still have to face that. That's facing evil, and I can express all kinds of confidence in what God has done. But that ultimate affirmation is one that I have not yet, nor will I, experience until that. And I am going to face, in all honesty, I'm going to be facing evil as I've probably never seen it, or I'm going to be having to deal with the sinfulness of my own life, the sinfulness of a creation as it is now, in a manner that I've not had to face before, that I've been able to put away, I've been able to sidestep. And there is a crunch in that. But I'm not sure that crunch necessarily says that that a physiological event is evil or is enemy.
So that the nature of death itself isn't evil, but it's what it comes from.
Yeah, that's
because death wasn't originally a part of God's plan. Is that right? From what I understand, that it was a result of it was a result of sin in the world, and that sin came first, and then death. And death in itself isn't sinful or evil, but it was the natural outgrowth or the natural consequence of it.
That starts to really tie into some interpretive what interpretive schools whichever way you want to go. I guess I would say death is a reality in the world.
Whether
you want to acknowledge or stand on that in that kind of interpretive principle of saying that it really wasn't part of God's intention, but it has been given to us after it came into the world after sin, or whether you want to kind of hold to an interpretive principle that says that that the whole of the, for example, the early Genesis narrative is descriptive of condition. Whichever way, I think that really that the outcome is the same.
That death makes you face the sinfulness of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I've got some of my own theories about when death happens. It seems to me that that when I experience that sinfulness, if we can use that term, at a level that exceeds my system. We use thresholds of pain, for example, or tolerance levels for various drugs. That when I experience that kind of radical disharmony or disorder or sinfulness, that at a level that exceeds my individual capabilities, that's when I'll die. That's when death occurs. you know, I guess that's also a way for me of being able to tie the fact that that yes, there is that evil, the sinfulness that is confronted. And out of that experience, I also hold a confidence and trust. Or in the midst of that experience, I still hold confidence and trust.
It seems to me that as soon as one associates death with evil, that you have raised one of the most difficult theological issues that there is to be raised. The business simply of accounting for evil in the same world in which we say there is an all-powerful, loving God, it's very difficult to do. And so that if you want to understand something about the meaning of death in terms of the meaning of evil, then you have a formidable task before you. But if you're interested in thinking very hard about that, there's an excellent book entitled Evil and the God of Love, which it's a survey of some of the philosophical and theological approaches to the problem of evil, written by a very clear-headed theologian named John Hick. Evil and the God of Love, written for anybody who simply wants to wrestle with a difficult problem. It does not presuppose that you are either a theologian or philosopher. But well, this discussion can continue as long as anyone would like it to, but I don't want any of you to feel that you're discourteous if you leave.